We went out. I followed Andy and Hio out onto the ice today, and we're looking for good places to find young ice. But we weren't. It looks like that stuff is a little further out, and we were trying to stay a little closer to shore just in case we needed to run back here and use this phone, which is the case. The satellite phone wasn't working this morning. Hio is a researcher at University of Alaska, and his student is Andy Mahoney. He's a PhD student. I'll let them introduce themselves here. Say a little bit about yourself.
Sorry, I'm just blowing my nose here. It looks pretty good that you're only listening on the phone. This doesn't look good. I'm Hio. Sorry for being late here. We just had to get back with a couple of samples that we need to process right away. That's basically what we did this morning. It's actually quite nice out here, nice and calm, and fairly warm. I don't know, it's what, around about 0 degrees, Andy, or something like that. Yeah, even warmer. So Andy is sitting next to me here. Maybe he can introduce himself.
I'm Andy Mahoney. I'm a PhD student working with Hio. I come up to Barrow with him, sometimes on my own, hold in the ice, place equipment in the ice, and watch how it grows and moves around.
All right. We were out there earlier today, and we pulled a couple of cores out of the bottom, and the very bottom of the core had a lot of brownish-green stuff in it. Can you guys talk to me a little bit about what that is, and then that blue chemical stuff you were putting on the ice?
Yeah. Now it's spring up here, or spring is starting in Barrow. People are getting ready for the spring whale hunt, and at the same time, you know, just like in Una, you guys already have robins out there, I would suspect, and out here in the ice, you see the first sign of springs when the ice turns greenish brown at the bottom of the ice, and those are little algae. It's like the, you know, just like the buds are coming out on willows and other trees in interior Alaska, not quite yet, but they're getting there. And similar to that, you have little plants that are budding here at the bottom of the ice. And if you take one of these cores, you know, it's a long cylinder of ice. I'm actually holding one here right now, and in fact, I don't know whether you can hear this, I'm banging it on the table. It's a pretty solid piece of ice, 4 inches or 10 centimeters in diameter. And we took a couple of those this morning. They're about a meter long total, just over 3 feet. And at the very bottom, there's a couple of inches or a couple of centimeters of very, very brown ice. The rest of the ice is, you know, pretty whitish looking, looks kind of bland. But then at the very bottom, you've got this brown stuff, and that's full with these very, very small microorganisms. They're the size of about a hundredth of a centimeter or a hundredth of an inch. But because there's so many of them, the ice actually does look brown. And maybe Andy can tell you, I mean, it's not just that type of organism, but when we were drilling, it was actually quite funny to see something else happening. Andy can probably tell you about that.
Just as we've taken the core out of the ice, the seawater flushed up it from in the hole that we just drilled, and out of the surface of the seawater jumped a little shrimp out and landed on the ice, but we pushed him back into the water so that he could go join his pals.
All right. I'm going to do a quick roll call here. The Albanil family is on?
Yep.
Okay, the Stone family is on?
Yep.
The Hansen family.
That's correct.
Okay. Did Huna hook up? Doesn't sound like it. Is Barrow on? Okay. Is Tanana Middle School in Fairbanks on? All right. Is anybody in Kotzebue listening in? Okay, if I hear someone beep in while we're doing this, I'll just stop and identify who it is here. Let's start with question number one. Can the Stone family ask question one?
Yes. What is the difference between sea ice and pack ice?
Yeah, sorry, what's your name?
Claren.
Claren?
Yeah.
Okay. That's actually kind of a tough question, and we got three people sitting here, and I think they all have a different opinion about what the difference is. But sea ice is the most general term. Do you know about glaciers, Claren?
Yes.
So you know how you have different types of glaciers. You know, you got glaciers that end in seawater, and you've got glaciers that end on land. And then you have the really big glaciers, the ice caps, and there's lots of different types of sea ice as well. But the general term that describes all of these different types of ice that float on the ocean and that form from ocean water is sea ice. So any piece of ice, and a good way to tell actually is most of that sea ice, well, first of all, if it's floating on the ocean, you know, it's a good chance that it's sea ice. But then if you lick it, most of the sea ice is actually salty. So you can tell the difference there. And if you have fresh sea ice, you don't want to put that into your drinks because you're going to end up, unless you're having, V8 or some kind of tomato juice, because there's a lot of salt in there. So sea ice is the general term. And then pack ice actually is, it's pack ice or the ice pack. That's a really, really large expanse, a really, really large area of sea ice, such as, for instance, the pack ice of, what's the ocean called north of here? You know?
The Arctic. The Arctic.
What is it, the Arctic?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the Arctic Ocean, exactly. So you can actually say that the Arctic Ocean as a whole is covered by the pack ice, or the ice pack. That's the difference between those two terms.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Yep.
Yep.
And the Hansen family, can you ask question number nine? Number nine.
Number nine?
Yeah.
Okay. How do you use chemistry in your work?
All right. Sorry, what's your name?
Tiana.
Donna?
Tiana.
Oh, Tiana. Sorry. That's a good question, too, because Patrick was already mentioning earlier that these cores that we took today, we actually applied a bit of blue stain, and this is harmless stain. I mean, you can drink it. It's almost like vegetable coloring, but when we apply that to the ice, it actually helps us understand what's going on inside the ice. So chemistry is, for us, is very useful, first of all, because it helps us understand things that we can't really see. You know that chemistry is a lot about individual atoms or molecules and about different chemical compounds, and a lot of important things in the ice occur on the scale of molecules or atoms. So we actually need chemistry to figure out, for instance, what the little plants that we saw this morning are eating. You know, they're not eating because they're plants. They actually, I don't know what you call it, but they photosynthesize. Do you know that term? Do you know what photosynthesis is?
Yes, sir.
Yep. In order to do photosynthesis, you actually have to have water. You have to have light. You have to have carbon dioxide or some other form of carbon, and you have to have nutrients. So all of this is chemistry, and that chemistry is very important in our work, not just for the plants, but also for the ice itself, because, again, if you think about, for instance, people salting roads in wintertime to get rid of the ice or to avoid the roads icing over, again, that's chemistry, and the same kind of chemistry, the chemistry of putting salt on roads to reduce the amount of icing is going on in the sea ice the whole time.
All right. Albanil family, can you ask question number 15?
Yeah.
How long have you been doing research on the Arctic coast near Barrow, and what makes it a good area to do your research?
Thanks. What's your name?
Jesse.
Stephanie?
Dusty?
Dusty?
Jesse.
Okay,
sorry, you're kind of hard to hear, so if I screw up on your name, don't blame me. It's all on the phone line. Well, maybe Andy and I can answer that together. I've been doing research here in Barrow for the past 4 years now. I actually moved to Alaska from Germany. I'm originally from Germany. And one of the reasons why I moved to Alaska, apart from the fact that it's one of the greatest places to be on Earth, but you know more about that than I do, is that it's great for the kinds of research that we're doing. And if you want to study ice, well, you know, the people out in Barrow here or out in Kotzebue, I mean, they live with the ice 9 months out of the year. So people know a lot about ice here. You can have very good access to the ice. You know, here I am, I'm sitting here talking to you, and just 10 minutes ago, I was out there drilling ice cores. So it's a very convenient way to work, it's a combination of all these different things. The fact that you have, that the ice is important for Alaska in this area, the fact that a lot of people know a lot about ice, and we can talk to them and learn from them, and the fact that we can go out here and do experiments and do a very complicated and complex scientific research, but at the same time enjoy the safety of our research station here and be able to take expensive or complicated equipment out on the ice very easily. All of that is something that if you work in, for instance, more remote areas near the North Pole, for instance, and I've been doing a lot of research off ships before I came here. If you're on the ship, all of this is much, much more difficult. But maybe Andy can say a bit about why or how long he's been here and why he thinks this is a great place to do research.
This is my second year studying the sea ice in Barrow. As Hyo said, it's very easy to get to. We just jump on a plane from Fairbanks in the evening and we're up here in time for dinner. For my research, Barrow offered me access to two different parts of the Arctic Ocean. To the northwest, we have the Chukchi Sea, but to the northeast, we have the Beaufort Sea, two different parts of the Arctic Ocean, and my research involves studying both of those.
All right. Thank you. Stone family, can you ask question number two?
Yes. Does the pack ice support marine life like sea ice does?
Well, do you think you can answer that question already yourself? I mean, we were out there this morning, and I was talking about these different organisms or different life forms that we found. So, what do you think?
I think it does.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And also, if you remember, we talked about the first question, and that was you actually who asked that question, if I remember right. I mean, sea ice is the general term that describes all different kinds of pack ice or ice that's attached to the land. So, in fact, there really isn't as much of a difference between sea ice and pack ice, but all of them support a lot of life, and some of it is more difficult to see. For instance, if you go out now and you want to see the plants that are blooming here, you have to drill all the way through the ice. You can't see that from the surface, but then obviously we see other animals from the surface. I guess yesterday you already talked with our colleagues Don and Tom, so you've heard about, you know, polar bears that we find here. Obviously, there's a lot of seals here and walrus. There's a lot of whales and other birds that come up in summertime. And all of them, in one way or another, are actually very much dependent on the sea ice and on these very small organisms that live in the sea ice.
All right.
Thank you.
Hansons, can you ask question number 10? And remember, when you're getting on to ask a question, identify yourself. Say, my name's Patrick, and then go ahead and ask your question. That way we can identify which students we're talking to.
Okay. My name's Felicia. How did you get interested in ice core research?
Okay, her question was, how did you get interested in ice core research?
Yeah, good question. I sometimes wonder about that myself. You know, when I'm out there and I'm freezing and cold, but then you look around and you remember, wow, you know, I got into this because, first of all, I like ice. I like snow and ice. I think ice is one of the more interesting materials on our planet. And if you think about it, you know, most of the planet is covered by water, right? So about two-thirds or more than two-thirds of the planet are covered by water, oceans. But then probably about one-tenth or 10% of the planet are actually covered by sea ice. And so it's a pretty important part of what the Earth is about. And that's one of the reasons why I'm interested in it. Another reason is that, you know, just as we were talking about earlier, in sea ice, you can study both very small things, such as very small organisms, or you can study the chemistry that occurs between different atoms or molecules. But then at the same time, while you're doing that, you're also studying the very large scale, how, for instance, the sea ice plays a role in the climate of the Arctic or the climate of the Earth as a whole. So that's one of the reasons why I got interested. But I'll ask Andy, see what he has to say about this.
I like ice because I quite enjoy climbing in the winter and so on, and so I figured I quite liked ice, and then I spoke to Tayo one day, and he suggested sea ice, and he made all the same arguments that he's just made, and I made the decision to come here and study sea ice, and I'm very glad that I did.
All right. The Albanil family, can you ask question number 16?
Yeah, what kind of results have you obtained from your work, and have you observed any changes during that time?
All right, sounds like your dogs are interested in that question, too. So, we worked on several different projects, and I will just pick one example, and then maybe Andy can pick another example. But I'd like to say that in ice research, what's interesting in ice research, in particular in Alaska, is that it has a lot of different applications. For instance, if you're out here in Barrow, or if you talk to the people in Kotzebue, for instance, the ice is very important for protecting the coasts during part of the year. It's very important for the people who live along the coast because it allows them to travel across the ice with snow machine or dog sled. But then at the same time, obviously also the ice prevents ships from getting to a lot of places in wintertime. So it's very important for those reasons, and that's some of the things we're studying to some extent as well. But one of the things that I learned from working in Barrow and working on a drifting ice station in the Arctic Ocean that I'm really very excited about is something that relates to albedo. And I don't know whether you talked about albedo yesterday with Don and Tom, but albedo is, do you remember what albedo is?
The sun reflecting off the ice?
Yeah, exactly. And as you know, I mean, that's a very important part of the ice, is that it is like a big mirror that reflects a lot of the sunlight back away from the Earth. So if you take away that ice, you can change the amount of heat that the Earth receives from the sun by quite a large amount. And what we found in the last 3 or 4 years, and other people have been looking at that before, so we're basically continuing a long line of research, is that the amount of sunlight that is actually taken up by the ice depends very much by the way meltwater that forms at the surface of the ice then spreads and trickles around on the surface of the ice. And in fact, you can think of these little meltwater puddles or ponds or lakes just like you would think of lakes in a very large landscape. It's exactly the same kind of process where you have lakes forming and they spread and they shrink, but they do this at very fast rates, much faster than people have thought about before, and we were fortunate enough to be here at a time where we could observe all of this and could see how fast meltwater lakes form on the ice and vanish again, and we're hoping to learn more about how this affects the ice on the scale or on a global scale, on the scale of the entire Earth. That's something that we've been very excited about, and we're trying to now work on creating mathematical models to be able to actually predict how this would affect the ice cover. So that's one result out of our research here in Barrow. But Andy may have something else to talk about.
Sure. I'm studying how the landfast ice grows each year, how it changes, with the seasons, and then how it melts and breaks up in the summer. And this is an annual cycle. And what I'm quite excited about is some events that have happened in the last few years that apparently haven't happened in the last 100 years or so. So maybe we're seeing signs of a change in the Arctic Ocean, and perhaps this is some reflection of that change that I'm seeing now. And but one of the events I'm talking about that people in Barrow know of is the ice that's normally attached to the land and allows hunters to go out onto the ice to hunt seal and whales. Normally that's very safe at this time of year, and it's safe right up through to the whaling season. But a few weeks ago, that ice vanished. It blew offshore, and there were people on that ice. Fortunately, they were all made safe by the Barrow Search and Rescue. But this type of event has never happened before. And it's, for my research, it's quite exciting times, but we've got to bear in mind the safety of the ice as well.
Yeah, and the other event they're referring to, this is Patrick, was it 4 or 5 years ago that during whaling season they had another large ice event and they ended up stranding 40-some people out there, and they had to get all of their snowmobiles and all the people helicoptered back to shore. So it's a major event up here. Can the Stone family ask question number 3?
Yes, this is Quinn. What is the oldest ice sample you have found?
So how old do you think sea ice gets?
I don't know.
Okay. When I started working on ice, I didn't know myself either, but obviously other people knew. And sea ice, because it floats on the ocean and because a lot of it melts every year, actually doesn't get all that old. So if I were to ask you, what do you think typically is older, glacier ice or sea ice?
I would say glacier ice.
Yeah, exactly, because if you think about it, a glacier is sitting in one spot for a very, very long time. It moves very slowly,
mm-hmm.
and it can get quite old. Do you have any idea what the oldest glacier ice, for instance, in Greenland, how old that might be?
Hundreds of years.
Several years?
Hundreds.
Oh, yeah, even more. That ice in Greenland is as old as more than 100,000 years.
Oh, my God.
So glacier ice is extremely old in parts, but sea ice actually is much, much younger. Sea ice is much more dynamic. It's much more active. And as Andy just explained, for instance, you know, it breaks off and then new ice starts growing. So, for instance, today we were out on ice that was just a few weeks or maybe a few months at the very most old. So if you're out here in Barrow, most of the ice that you find is only about a year or maybe 2 years old. But then if you go to other parts of the Arctic Ocean, the oldest ice that you would find is probably about 10 years old. And in fact, people have found that in recent years, the ice overall in the Arctic Ocean got younger and younger. There was less and less older, thicker ice around.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. The Hansen family, can you ask question number 12?
Sure. I'm Luke. How much
evidence?
Huh?
Oh, I just said hello, Luke. Go ahead and ask your question.
How much evidence of animal and plant life do you find in your research?
Well, I'll let Andy take care of that. He's the polar bear expert.
I've been lucky enough to see at a safe distance quite a few polar bears up here. They're very majestic and beautiful animals. But on a day-to-day basis, we see Arctic fox. In the springtime, there's a tremendous number of migratory birds that come up here. I'm no bird expert, but certainly Canada geese and many types of eider come up this way. I was lucky enough to see the migration of the whales last year, and I saw beluga whales and bowhead whales swimming up the coast from Bees down to the south, and they swim up past Barrow and enjoy the summer in Canada, in the Canadian archipelago. I've seen seals, I've seen different types of seal. Today we saw a shrimp, and we saw a little microbiology in the bottom of the sea ice. We've seen people fishing for trout in the early spring here in Barrow. But although we don't study the wildlife, it is an essential part of sea ice, and we're surrounded by it when we do our research here.
Yeah. This is Patrick. I teach in the winters, but in the summers I do bird work up here, and I do goose surveys. And there's actually four species of geese that actually live up here on the coastline. One is snow geese, and then the Canada geese, like Andy mentioned, and then also greater white-fronted geese, and then a small goose called a brant. And then you also see lots of tundra swans, several species of eiders, and all kinds of stuff. We also get the caribou migrate up into this area to calve and spend the summer. So you see, in the spring and in the summer, you see these huge influxes of migratory animals. Let's go to question number 18 with the Albanil family.
I'm Jesse. What type of education is needed to do the kind of work that you do? Where did you go to school?
The interesting thing about ice research is that there's people from lots of different backgrounds that come into this line of work. For instance, I myself started out studying what is called mineralogy. It's about the physics of minerals and the chemistry of minerals, and then I went over into geophysics. Andy here, well, he can tell you what he did, in general, you can if you want to study the sea ice cover from the perspective of climate or climate change, you can be anything ranging from a geologist or a geophysicist to being an atmospheric scientist or just a plain physicist. But then there's also, we're working a lot with biologists, so we have a lot of colleagues who are studying the organisms in sea ice, and they're all biologists or chemists. So the interesting thing about ice research is that, you know, the main thing is you have to be interested in the work, and you have to have certain skills. You have to know about math, about mathematics, you have to know about physics, about chemistry, or biology in some cases. But then it's not so much what it says on your, you know, on your diploma or on your graduation diploma, but it's more about the skills and the knowledge that you have. And let's see what Andy says. I mean, I have a diploma. Actually, I went to university in Germany, so I have a diploma in mineralogy, and then I have a PhD in geophysics. But let's see what Andy has done here.
Okay, I went to school in England. You might be able to guess from that funny way that I talk. I mostly concentrated, because the way that the English system is set up, I mostly concentrated on math and physics and computing. And I wanted to go into physics originally. But then I became a climber, and so I didn't want to be stuck inside a physics lab, so I took geophysics, which allowed me to get outside in the world and see the physics of the world around me. And I got a bachelor's degree from the University of East Anglia in England in geophysics. And that's the education I needed to come and do my PhD here in Fairbanks. But as I found out and Haya mentioned, that only gets you so far, because you need to know how to drive a snow machine, you might need to know how to fix a snow machine, you need to know how to melt a frozen drill when it's minus 40 outside, so there's a lot of things that you need to know that school doesn't necessarily teach you, so it's a lot of fun out here.
All right. Let's see. The Stone family, can you ask question number 7?
Yes. Why are there dark and light rings in the ice core samples?
Okay, now, did you see those light and dark rings in the ice core samples yourself in some photograph or image?
Not before.
Ah, but have you seen them now, or do you know what you're... Do you know what the question is about?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay, good. Always, you know, that's more important, knowing what a question is about than knowing the answer. But what we find is when we take ice cores, or you may also have seen pictures of these very large slabs of ice that we cut, or a colleague of ours cuts with a chainsaw, and when you take those out, you can see that there's light layers and there's dark layers. And what do you think those might be? I mean, do you have any idea yourself what could cause that?
Maybe climate change?
Maybe climate change?
But on a much shorter time scale, because if you remember what I said earlier, you know, for instance, today we were out on ice that was probably about a month and a half old, maybe 2 months. So during that period, the ice grew to about a meter or about 3 feet thickness. So the rings that we see in that ice are a result of changes in the way the ice grows during that month or 2 months. So the rings that you see in the ice are correspond to much, much shorter time periods than, for instance, the rings that you would see in a tree. But at the same time, the rings that you see in the ice, or the layers that you see in the ice as you go down, are similar to tree rings, because as you go down in an ice core, or if you look at a piece of ice and you start at the top and you go to the bottom, the ice gets progressively younger and younger and younger, because it's being added on at the bottom. So the newest ice layer is always at the bottom. So if you start from the bottom and you go to the top, you get from the very young ice to the older ice. And these rings or layers are typically several centimeters or a few inches thick. So if you think about, well, how long does it take for ice to grow by a couple of centimeters? Well, that's anything from, you know, on the order of a day to maybe a week. So these layers tell you something about what's going on in the ocean or in the air above the ice during that time period. And that's actually one of the things that we're interested in, that we're studying, is trying to find out whether we can tell more about, precisely about what the ocean was doing, whether it was flowing faster or slower, whether it was warming or cooling, or whether the air was getting colder or warmer during the period of ice growth by looking at these cores. So so these layers or these rings really are in part due to the weather, but then also in part they're due to changes in the ocean.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep. Hansen family, can you ask question number 13?
All right. Does albedo on sea ice differ from the albedo of freshwater ice?
All right, that's a good question. Now, have you been on a lake recently?
Not recently, but I have been on a iced over lake before.
Yeah. So what did the surface of the lake when it wasn't covered with snow? What did it look like?
Almost smooth.
Almost blue. So it looked, and it was dark, right? Or pretty darkish.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, some lakes. For instance, in the vicinity of Fairbanks, we have a lot of lakes. If they freeze over, they're almost black. You know, the ice is very dark. In some areas where you have more bubbles in the ice is, as you say, it's more bluish or sometimes even whitish. And then if you go out here on the sea ice actually is much, much whiter and much lighter than lake ice. And the reason for that is that ice itself, if you look at a piece of very, very clear ice, you can look through the ice. And if, for instance, you're out on a lake and the lake has, a foot of ice on it, and the ice is very clear, doesn't contain any air bubbles, then you can actually look through the ice and you can see what's underneath the ice, whether there's plants or maybe even fish or something. Now, if you were on a foot of sea ice, you could... In no way in the world could you ever look through a foot of sea ice because there's lots and lots of little bubbles of brine, of salt solution, and also of air in the sea ice, and those bubbles reflect the light and scatter the light so that, first of all, you can't look through the ice, so you can't look into the deep, dark ocean, but at the same time, a lot of the light is being reflected. So there's much more light being reflected by sea ice than by lake ice. And now the question I would ask you is, so what do you think is higher, the albedo of sea ice or the albedo of lake ice?
Probably the albedo of sea ice.
And that is because?
That's because the sea ice is lighter, so it reflects more light off.
Yeah, exactly. So in fact... You know, yesterday we were talking with Don and Tom about measuring albedo, I guess, and you can tell, I mean, you yourself, you can go out, and if you've done this a couple of times, you can get very good at it, and you can look out and you can say, whoop, today the albedo of the ice is 0.6, or it's 0.7, and you can go to a lake and you can say, I mean, there's some lakes up here, for instance, that are very clear, they have an albedo of 0.1, you know, meaning that 9/10 of the light that comes in is actually passing through the ice and being absorbed and swallowed by the ice and the water, and 1/10 is being reflected, and then there's sea ice here without any snow on it that has an albedo of 0.6 or 0.7, meaning that about a third of the light is absorbed by the ice and 2/3 are actually being reflected.
Okay, Albanil family, can you ask question number 21?
Yes, I'm Willie. What is the thickest ice you have cored?
All right, good question. Well, let's ask Andy here, see whether he remembers what the thickest ice is that he has cored.
Well, the ice has been the thickest when I was up here last summer. And I was actually going through, and I was trying to find the thickest ice I could, and I drilled through a floe that was about 3 meters thick. And that was actually a floe that had been crushed up and made into a small ridge by the ice.
All right.
Do you know what an ice floe is?
Yes.
Yeah? So how do you spell flow?
F-L-O-W?
Nope, sorry. That's a different type of flow. The ice flow is actually spelled F-L-O-E. But don't worry about it. I have a lot of colleagues, and sometimes I myself make that mistake. So it's not, you know, no reason to worry here.
This is Patrick speaking. This reminds me of a question they were asking before you guys walked in here, and we were talking about how the flows come together and form these pressure ridges, and they were wondering, how dangerous are those? When they get up really high, do they fall down on top of you? Do you need to be aware of ice coming over the top, or...
That's the mountaineer's question.
We'll let Andy answer that one then.
They can be dangerous. They can be unstable, particularly as they're forming. Blocks are rolling over each other. Blocks are falling down the sides. And you probably don't want to be near one as it's forming. And I was climbing around on one last year, and it was still quite unstable, and so I decided that I shouldn't be climbing around on it anymore.
Okay.
Yeah, they can... Sorry, maybe I can... Actually, I just noticed I've been really shouting a lot here, and you guys' ears probably heard, but I'll speak a bit quieter here and see whether you can still hear me. But talking about these pressure ridges, actually, that's a good question, because I was at an ice camp 3 years ago, and we had a large tent that was made up out of that was reinforced with steel. Steel tubing of about an inch diameter, and that tent was used to house our snow machines. And at the exact spot where that tent stood, within about 50 minutes, a pressure ridge formed, and the snow machines, people were actually able to get the snow machines out of the tent, but the tent and the iron, the steel, you know, the steel bars were completely crushed. So these pressure ridges can form very fast, and there are stories of Arctic explorers or of natives on the ice who happened to be in a spot where a pressure ridge was forming, and that actually, if you don't watch out, that can happen extremely fast.
All right. Stone family, can you ask question number 6?
Yes. Who supports your research?
Sorry, so what was the question again?
Who supports your research?
Oh, okay. Well, that's also a good question. Part of, obviously, we have to find our own support for the research. For instance, Andy is being supported out of a project that I wrote jointly with some other people, and there's different sources of funding or of support. One source of support that's very important for us is the National Science Foundation. That's a federal science agency. They have a long tradition of supporting good research. They are very careful about the types of projects they fund. If, for instance, I want to do certain type of research, I have to write a proposal, and then that gets sent in, and as many as 10 different people, 10 different scientists and experts look at that, and they say, well, you know, this proposal is good or this is bad and so on. And then once you've been through that process, eventually, at least you hope, you get some support. So the National Science Foundation supports a lot of our work. We also get support from NASA, from the National Aeronautics and Space Agency. We have one project where we're using satellite data to study the ice. And then we're also having support from other smaller sources. It's actually interesting. It's interesting that what you want to try and do is, obviously, you always want to be able to demonstrate that your research is...
Hey, Mr. McClucky, come here.
...is interesting and is at the same time also useful. So sometimes we're also hoping, at least at some point, that we're doing something that really helps the state or other people.
Okay. Hansen family, can you ask question 14?
Okay, this is Felicia. Is albedo studied on sand deserts?
Her question was, is albedo studied on sand deserts?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, there's people who are studying albedo on sand deserts because if you think about it, you know, if the albedo of a sand desert is very low, then there would be much more sunlight that would be absorbed or swallowed by the desert, and it would get even hotter. Now, if you think about it, do you think the albedo of a desert is higher or lower than the albedo of a forest?
We couldn't hear that one. If you could repeat that.
I don't know.
Okay.
Oh, okay.
Well, if you've ever seen a picture of a desert, you know, or if you've ever seen a movie in a desert, I mean, the desert also looks pretty bright, so it actually has a comparatively high albedo, certainly much higher than the albedo of the forest, probably twice as high. But even so, even the deserts with the highest albedos, they only have an albedo that's about half of the albedo of sea ice. Sometimes it's only about a third of the albedo of sea ice.
Okay, the Albanil family, can you ask question number 27?
Yeah. Which one?
Number 27.
27. Okay. I'm Willie. How long will you continue your work there?
Well, this time up, we're really coming up for a short visit only, for a few days, and then Andy will be back later in May. I will actually be working on a ship studying the pack ice north of here. So we're definitely hoping to continue the work through this season and then several seasons from here. The important thing about this is that if you only come up once or twice, you may find conditions that are not typical for the longer term. And because we're interested and understanding how climate change is up here, we need to talk to people who have much more experience and to know this place for a longer period of time. That's obviously the local people here in Barrow or in other villages, but we also need to do our measurements over several years, so we're hoping to continue this research for some more years.
Okay, I'm going to stop with the questions that we had done for preparation here and ask you if you have any specific ones anymore. First, we'll go with the Stone family. Do you guys have any more questions?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. What about the Hansen family?
I don't think so.
Okay. And what about the Albanil?
Yeah, I do.
Okay.
I'm Willie. Have you ever named an animal you've come across there at the Arctic or anywhere during your research?
Well, let's ask Andy first. I got to think about that. Have you ever named an animal?
I haven't named an animal myself, but I do know of two polar bears that I saw up here last year that probably have names now because they're actually in San Diego Zoo now. So I saw them up here in the wild, but I think they probably have names at the zoo they're at in San Diego.
Yeah, and the problem is, you know, with the algae, you know, we see all these little microorganisms in the ice. If you want to give names to those, you know, it's going to take you half a year just to get through those hundreds and thousands of algae in a single core. So we usually just talk to all of them if we speak with the animals here.
All right. First of all, let me thank both Kyle and Andy here for spending time with us and showing us this ice core and answering questions and stuff. And good questions today, everybody. If you prepare your questions for tomorrow and get me 5 to 10 of them by early evening, I'll do the same thing I did last night and get them back to you early in the morning. If you check out the website later this afternoon under Ask a Scientist, you can talk to both Hio and Andy there, and you can check out photos from today. I'll be going back out with them and finishing ice cores, and you can get a sense of what was happening out on the ice before we came back in and what they do for work up here.
And this
you can
will
check
be
out
the Arctic Alive site.
You can check out the website from last night, too, and it has all the photos from yesterday's activities. So, have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Bye.